Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold!
Buchanan with the cross in towards Alphonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar! A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades! Finally arrives!
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo, Alexander Gonge-Rujic, and your host, Ben Steiner.
Welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 138 of NFP. Ben Steiner alongside Peter Galindo and Alex Gonge-Rujic. Peter and I in the same room, my new apartment in Toronto. Alex in Vancouver, a bit of a timing mistake, had him wake up a little too early. It is on me. It is my timing mistake. I should clarify that. I was never too bright in terms of math and in grade school. Make sure to follow us all on social as well as at Northern Football on each platform and rate, review, and subscribe to the show to wherever you get your podcasts. Well, we'll get into our CPL recap right off the bat and some bad news in terms of the CPL. CPL to Saskatoon has hit a major roadblock. The Prairie Land Board of Directors, who own the land on which the club stadium was proposed, and Living Sky Sports and Entertainment, who own the tentative CPL expansion rights, have mutually agreed to call off the project, which is pretty disappointing considering this comes after more than 2 years after the initial expansion announcement. This wasn't like an intention announcement. This was, we're expanding.
Correct.
And there was interviews with the owners, and it was a full sort of same level as the Vancouver announcement.
Yep.
And no Saskatoon team.
The Dave Klanikin era, gotta love it, right?
Well, that's it. And I think that's the one thing that's kind of, worth noting in this whole story. Because obviously it's been a less than ideal end, but I mean, first of all, it was an intention without a stadium, and that was always a big risk because it was contingent on acquiring the stadium. As we found out, that was a lot less straightforward than those first plans that came out. We remember the racetrack. We remember the proposed like designs that were out there. It looked great and all, but of course, the stadium wasn't actually secured. Of course, it's something that we'll dive into it with some of the questions. It was a big learning lesson. I think we've kind of seen it since then that with Vancouver, there was more of a plan in place. There's more, concrete ownership, a stadium location, et cetera. Even the Windsor team that was floated around, ditto is more of just an intention. There wasn't, as much of the Saskatoon one was like very much for whatever reason, like we're expanding. But in contingent on us finding a stadium, whereas I think kind of once, as you saw in Windsor, is like, okay, look, we're interested in Windsor. This, Dave Klanikin, funnily enough, is going to get exclusive rights to this area. But it's very much like, again, he has to now go get a stadium. He has to go get all that sort of stuff. So I think it was just a good, learning lesson that you now in terms of expansion, you need a stadium, you need an ownership group. And obviously Saskatoon didn't have that at the time. And that being the stadium. And I think you see now that that's kind of why it fell apart and maybe it was a bit premature. And look, honestly, I think it's something where it's not the end of the world. I mean, we'll see why shortly, but still it's something that certainly hurts for fans in Saskatchewan because I know they were looking forward to it. And I think it would have been a nice addition to the CPL. And hopefully it's something that comes back around. But of course, a stadium is going to be a big important part of that.
I think a lot of the issue that I have necessarily with it was the messaging initially, because I even looked back at a lot of that initial messaging and it was CPL expands to Saskatoon for whatever season it was. I can't remember off the top of my head. And so you felt like this was coming. You felt like it was official. Whereas when you look at the Windsor one and also David Klanikin with a bit of a David Beckham move there, the two are a little bit different in other ways, but a bit of a similar move with him basically awarding the CPL rights to himself, even that was just sort of like, we're going to explore whether Windsor could potentially work. It wasn't, this is the plan, here's the stadium renderings, here's what we're going to do. And so to pull the plug on Saskatoon seems just a little off, and it feels like something really did hit a major bump in the road. I'm also, I don't know whether I'm surprised or not that they're not exploring the idea of Husky Stadium. I know that university stadiums have not been the preferred way when you consider the way York has gone and when you also consider the need to not have the gridiron there. But why not take a look at that for a couple of years until you can find another solution and hopefully avoid a New York City FC situation.
But it's also worth noting too that it could still happen, right? They just have to find another stadium location and project, and the bureaucratic red tape is likely what led to this, because we saw reports from a few months ago that this could hit a snag in terms of getting it past council and all the other stuff that we see in this country. It's not even exclusive to Saskatchewan either. You see this all over the place now. It can be very hard to secure land for a stadium. Just ask Inter Miami, just ask New York City FC, although they have made a lot of progress in that way after several years. But it is worth noting that it isn't dead. And I think another, interesting layer to this is, wasn't the Kelowna bid also kind of tied into the Saskatchewan one in terms of like they'll both be unveiled in 2024 so that we keep the even number of teams in the CPL? And Kelowna looked far more, I guess, tangible would be the right word, because they had a couple of potential properties that they could use. And we know that the area is always desperate for, you know, extra entertainment. Kelowna's a fast rising community as
tournament
well.
Capital of Canada.
So, you know, that also would have been a very nice addition as well. And now they've also kind of set back the Kelowna bid on top of the Saskatoon bid. And also kind of goes to show you that the current CPL landscape, and this is one of the things that you can credit the Mark Noonan era for, is that they are being very cautious with it. Now, it has become a difficulty to find prospective owners and to actually get teams in Quebec, maybe another one in the Maritimes, what have you. But at least they're being cautious with it, and they're not just willy-nilly awarding all of these rights and unveiling these expansion teams when they're still very, very far away from actually making it a reality.
And from Nick Anderson, what does the Saskatoon news mean for CPL expansion, and when can we expect to see the next expansion side hit the pitch? At this point, it's not going to be 2024. You probably would have heard it by now. I mean, Vancouver was late in the process announcing, but it wasn't sort of this late, I don't think.
Willoughby helped as well.
Willoughby helped. Having the structure of the Langley Event Center there helped as well. Of course, the ownership group already in the CPL probably helped as well. So you could sort of make that happen on short notice. I'm not sure that you could necessarily make somewhere happen on short notice unless somebody randomly popped up and said they wanted to put a team in Edmonton.
Yeah, exactly. Or wherever it happens to be. Quebec, I know that's been floated around a lot. The Maritimes, that's been floated around a lot. It just means that I think a lot more owners, and this is going to be by mandate now, they're going to be more careful when it comes to their planning of an expansion team, right? Especially when it comes to the stadium, which is always the number one issue that they run into when they're starting a team, because it's easy to create a club, create the branding, hire staff, bring in players. The difficult part is getting the stadium right and finding the location, finding the land, and creating that stadium experience. So that's really going to be the big one here. And that's why I think the York United, future York United owners anyways, they have a little bit of an advantage in that they have the Woodbine Stadium that's going to come in, and they can at least make that their own, whereas at York Lions Stadium, they can't necessarily do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think 2024, as mentioned, it's going to be a very big stretch, just because also as well, like, would it be worth rushing a team just to bring in 9 when, as mentioned, bringing it up to 10 would make a lot of sense, just so you have an even competition? Because one thing about 8-team league, it's been perfect in terms of just how balanced it's been. You play everyone 4 times, you get a nice 28 games. You get to 9, it's a bit complicated. There's always a team having a bye, etc. So it could make sense. It could just make sense to also not rush and focus on properly securing the next 2 teams, so you can get up to a number like 10 properly. So, and there's definitely, I mean, there's still interest in expansion. I mean, again, Kelowna has been floated about. Those ones have been, you know, Kelowna has been working on this one for a while. So hopefully that's something where that finds fruit. You know, again, Quebec remains a fluid situation, whereas, of course, you know, hopefully some ownership steps up in Quebec, but there have been names who have been exploring the possibility from Quebec. I know, of course, the league wants Quebec to come in, and as they should, because, I mean, I think that's just, again, a no-brainer market. So those are potentially, maybe hopefully all goes right there. They secure stadiums, they secure owners, etc. Those two teams come in, then 2025, you get a nice round expansion and go from there. But I think also one thing is, you don't want to rush, you know, expansion either, if you know, unless you need to. And I don't think at this stage, you know, just focus on building what's there, the product that's there, you know, and then that will only help expansion. Because if you rush things and maybe they go wrong, like the Saskatchewan thing, that will only look bad. Whereas if you take your time and you secure the right location, everything, I think that will be more worth it in the long run. So hopefully 2025 is in mind with that, so that things are done right, and that, you know, those new teams that do come in have the proper conditions to be able to, from day one, be able to hit the ground running.
And while we were dealing with John Herdman mania on last week's podcast, Calgary's Gauthier Ntaigne has moved on loan to an ancien Ligue 2, with the deal set to become permanent before the end of the season for a reported $500,000 fee, which would be a league record in the CPL.
Yeah, and that's a massive thing as well, in that really for the player, for the club, as well as the league as a whole, like, this is a win-win-win scenario, because a player with 1,000 career professional minutes or thereabouts is moving to Europe, so that's massive for the player because he gets to take another step in his career. It's huge for the Calgary pipeline, because now you have Joel Waterman, Dominic Zator, Victor Loturi, and now throw Gauthier Ntaigne into the mix in terms of players who've played for Calgary. They've moved on to greener pastures. I know that Dominic Zator obviously took that stop at York first and then eventually moved to Poland, but regardless, he's a Calgary alumnus. And they're all doing very well overseas. So the fact that Ntaigne is the latest in the Calgary pipeline to make that move, and Arab and Pepel as well, is another name that also made that jump early in his career too. And now he's in the English system. And a lot of times, especially when you have that passport, if you just get your foot in the door, that can open up a lot of opportunities. So that is great for Calgary, because the pipeline is obviously thriving. You get that money in, you can reinvest it into the academy or into the club in general, what have you. And then for Ntaigne, as I said, he gets to make the next step. Now, it is going to be a massive adjustment, and I'll get to why later, but basically when it comes to Ntaigne, I do think he can actually profile as a really solid fullback in Ligue 2, just based on his profile of player, because he's a tricky, dynamic winger. He's hardworking off the ball, as we've seen. You kind of have to be in Tommy Wealdon Jr.'s system. So all those traits will make him attractive to Annecy. But the big problem with players moving over there, especially from the CPL or from MLS, and maybe in some cases this isn't always the situation, because I don't want to question Tommy Wealdon Jr. or Bobby Smyrniotis or even James Merriman and Carlos Gonzalez for this particular thing, because I think they're very detail-oriented. But the biggest adjustment that those players have to make is the tactical adjustment, right? It's moving over to a league where everybody's at the same level of quality as you, but they might have extra years of quality coaching and tactical acumen that maybe you don't have. And that's the biggest issue for a lot of Canadian players. Like, I remember at the Gold Cup, one of our players actually admitted to us that he had never been shown video clips of his from training or games, never really got a lot of tactical coaching at his club. And it took a little bit of adjusting in that environment, in that Canadian national team environment, to get up to speed. To his credit, he did, and ended up having a very good tournament. But it kind of goes to show you that those are roadblocks that the Canadian player faces, and Diadi Nabsi faced that when he first got over there. So for Ntaigne, that's going to be probably the big adjustment. I would imagine Wealdon and, like I said, Smyrniotis, Merriman, Gonzalez, those guys are a bit more detail-oriented, so maybe the adjustment isn't as massive, but that is something to watch as he makes this transition. But it's obviously a terrific move all around.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, hat tip to Calgary, because again, that's another good export. And look, that's only helping the club. I mean, Wealdon Jr. has been, you know, pretty publicly open about how much these sales have meant. You know, he's mentioned in the past selling the likes of a Pepel and a Loturi have helped the club immensely to, you know, help with little stuff like your stadium, like help, you know, build the U21 team that they've also, you know, been pushing into the League One Alberta exhibition series. So, I mean, a feel like that, that's only going to help even more. And I mean, Wilden Jr. said as much after the Intigny sale. And I think it's also good because it's just only going to attract people to go play for this Cavalry system. I mean, we've already seen, for example, the fact that they've targeted someone like Emile Henry from Vancouver to come and potentially, you know, at 18, 19, be someone who, you know, can continue to grow. And maybe in a few years, we're talking about Emile Henry as, you know, that next sale. And there's a lot of fascinating players already in that system. You know, for example, Michael Harms, we've seen this year, just 18 as well. Like, Cavalry is building a pipeline. It's good because they're also doing a good job of surrounding them with veterans. So this is a team that's still going to be able to win now. What I like about this Intigny sale is that they've set themselves up for a move like this. But unlike last year where they lost two key members of Latoury and Pepple that kind of hurt their playoff hopes, I think they'll still be in a good position playoff-wise. They also signed a replacement technically in the likes of Willie Accio, in the way that Accio is kind of replicating a lot of what Intigny did on the left, on the right now for Cavalry. So they just position themselves quite well with overall with the sale. And I think it's good because, again, the CPL, it's good for these sorts of sales for the league. And now hopefully Intigny can adapt. I mean, the nice thing is that sort of speed will always, you know, coaches will always love that sort of speed because you can't teach it. He's very rapid, but he's also shown a lot of tactical growth in this short time this season, because at the start of the year, he was kind of just an out and out winger, and it was very much take guys on, cross, etc. And I think that's still part of his game. But by the end of the year, it was, okay, he's playing as a wing back. He's tracking back. He's having to defend 1v1. And I saw immense growth there. So hopefully that just shows that tactically when he heads to France, I'd profile him as a pretty good wing back. But of course, in the modern game, that will likely be, you know, either a fullback or a wingback. As we know now, so many teams play fluid formations where he might be a wingback on the ball and then maybe playing more of a back four off it. But I think with his speed, he can definitely do that. And I mean, of course, he'll keep growing tactically. So I think it'll be good to see how he develops. And hopefully maybe, you know, he can have a season like an Diadine Abzi. Of course, Abzi had a bigger resume in the CPL, so that helped his transition over. He was a bit older, but hopefully Intigny can maybe follow in similar footsteps to that.
And getting into the CPL results from the last week, Pacific down Valor 2-1, while Atletico Ottawa fell at home to Cavalry 2-1 as well. That one, an exciting one, decided pretty well right at the finish. Forge defeated Vancouver 3-0, and York United picked up a win away at the HFX Wanderers 2-1. Cavalry sit atop the table, and for the first time in a while, we're seeing some separation in the CPL standings. Cavalry sit atop with 39 points. Pacific in second, tied with Forge on 35 points. Fourth held by Atletico at 32, also tied with York United and the HFX Wanderers. Can you necessarily count out Valor yet with the way they've started to play, even despite the loss?
The gap is too big now. You know, if they were still within, I'd say, 6-7 points, that would be definitely feasible. But the fact that they're now 12 adrift. The fact that they're now 12 adrift with, what, basically 6 games to go is too big of a mountain to climb now. Because not only do you need to make up 12 points, you need to hope that the teams above them start losing. And to be fair, Forge is a team that usually finishes seasons strongly. Halifax Wanderers are one of the best defensive teams in the league. We know York United's issues defensively, but offensively, they're still putting in the goals. Atletico Ottawa, they're back to their usual Atletico Ottawa selves. Their DNA is back, especially with Nate Ingham fully fit again. So all those factors go against Valor. And it's, at the very least, it's going to be a fascinating race here down the stretch, because we very well know who at least two of the teams will probably be finishing in the top five. From here, it's very much going to be a toss-up, because you got Forge, Atletico, York, and Halifax all tied, and or there or thereabouts, kind of within 2 or 3 points of each other, and anything can swing from here. I still back Halifax to pick York, and that will end up probably being the top five for me, but it's certainly been a fascinating race the last few weeks, and it's going to be even more fascinating down the stretch.
Yeah, and I mean, it's fascinating too, because now little things come into play, like strength of schedule. Because that's for something where York, I'm curious now, because of course they have played the extra game versus a team like Halifax, but York plays four in a row at home right now. Like, they haven't been the greatest at home this year, but I mean, in terms of just any having a chance at the playoffs, that's a good chance to, you know, string some wins together. They've won two in a row, you know, these past 2 weeks. Grab a couple wins and then, you know, then they'll be in a good position. You look as well, Halifax as well has a pretty home heavy schedule, but as we've seen the last few games, teams are starting to play them pretty hard at Wanderers grounds because the secret's kind of out a bit on how dominant Halifax has been at home. So I think it'll be fascinating to see that battle between them and York. Ditto with Ottawa. They won five in a row at home, but then they've dropped three in a row at home as well because teams are coming in. It's just so open now, especially now across these six games. You're kind of, your strength of schedule has completely changed. So I think that's also going to be so intriguing as well. And you think of as well, like a final matchup. York plays Vancouver FC on the final match day of the season. That's something where maybe York will be 1 or 2 points away from booking a playoff spot. But then also, as we know, Vancouver is not an easy team. So that's not an easy matchup per se, but it could. It's just interesting to think that, like, on the last day as well, Pacific plays Cavalry away. Pacific have never beaten Cavalry in regular season play away. So it's, for example, if you're Pacific and you're 1 or 2 points off the title or 1 or 2 points off the top two and you're playing Cavalry away, that could end up potentially hurting them in their chance. So I think it's going to be fascinating to see how these little matchups play up. Because I look now at Cavalry being 4 points ahead. Well, they play Forge away this weekend, and Forge is definitely going to owe Cavalry one after Cavalry beat them pretty heavily last time out, 3-0. So I think if Forge goes out and gets a win, all of a sudden the tables open right back up again, and I think that's kind of going to be the fascinating battle to follow the rest of the way.
Are we surprised that Vancouver has been as bad as they have been this year? Like, really struggled to get any sort of momentum in terms of getting results. It's been touch and go in terms of personnel on the roster. Like, you have Sean Hundahl, but then all of the pretty well marquee names that came in that were supposed to kind of lead the club have either left or sort of shied away from whatever limelight there was. The attendance hasn't been there. Are we surprised that things have gone kind of so poorly for Vancouver in a first season, or have they actually not gone poorly?
They've been a little bit unlucky with injuries, at least on the pitch. That's probably the one determining factor. Not to mention, new teams usually take a little bit of time to gel. Like, when was the last time an expansion team was really able to start their first season strongly?
St. Louis.
Well, okay, outside of like
MLS. But MLS is, you can't do MLS because they're bringing in like, they're bringing in marquee players. They're like, they got the expansion draft.
They have bigger budgets, right?
I was going to say the expansion teams as well. We have to remember for Ottawa and Vancouver, they literally started from scratch. Like, it's like you are genuinely like, you don't even get like an expansion gift of, oh yeah, here's a player from each team in the league. No, it's like, okay, you have zero. You got to go basically scrap out a bunch of free agents plus local talent plus whoever internationals you can sign. It is a bit of a tougher gig than MLS, where you can sign three DPs right off the bat. You get five free expansion players. Like, it does change things a little, I'd say.
True. You did have
so all that to say to MLS
Next Pro.
Exactly. So it's all that to say, on the pitch, not as surprising. Off the pitch, maybe a little, but I mean, as we kind of know in Vancouver, winning is a huge part of what makes teams tick. And I think as well, just again, a lot of growing pains, figuring out the stadium location and Langley, getting people out, marketing. Those are all, you know, just growing pains that they'll have to work through. And I think, you know, as well, that kind of, it feels like the on and the off pitch kind of link in that regard.
And from Dan Clark, what can't BL team, as they currently are, would have the best chance to make run in the CONCACAF Champions Cup next year?
I think the easy answer is Forge, because they've been there and done that before. They have the experience. They have a deep squad. And that's not to say that other teams wouldn't have a shot. Like, the way that Pacific plays could maybe trouble some teams. Atletico Ottawa, the way they play, could trouble some teams as well. But there is something to be said about having the experience of playing in those environments before. And that comes into it as well. And it would depend on the draw too. But my immediate answer would be Forge, just for that one simple reason, whether people may like it or not.
I think the crux of this question is probably the as they currently are, because I think you look at Forge and potentially some of the moves that could be made from that roster, as well as on the touchline, like, is Smirniotis potentially joining the Canamente? And if he joins the Canamente or moves to another role, then are you looking at the same sort of experience within that roster?
But then that's not as they currently are, though.
That's
in the future.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying, that right? As they currently are, that's the crux of your question. Good question, Doug.
Yeah, I think Forge is probably the easy one because I think experience is so valuable. I also just think, I mean, you look at the depth of the roster. They're so deep across every position, which would be useful. Otherwise, I mean, again, another thing is we just haven't seen a whole lot of sample size in terms of teams other than Forge competing in CONCACAF, because Pacific showed very well, you know, dominated Waterhouse last year. And then, you know, they pushed a Costa Rican side to penalties, you know, and played relatively well across the tie. So, I mean, it shows that I think the CPL as a whole, that's, of course, CONCACAF League. We haven't really seen in Champions League. Forge did well against Cruz Azul, but that's also Forge. So because based on that, though, I'd say, again, Ottawa, based on the way they play and just how solid they are at the back, I think that kind of always would give them a chance in a kind of two-leg setting where you need things to, you know, you need to keep things tight. You need to keep things very, you know, organized at the back. So I'd say Ottawa's one, we're just based on their style of play. Cavalry is a bit of a wild card because I just feel like based on all the success they've had in the regular seasons of CPL, you'd feel like, you know, that should translate over to CONCACAF play. But I mean, who knows? I mean, hopefully, just based on the fact that he's, you know, had so much success in the CPL yet hasn't tasted CONCACAF play, you'd almost want Wheeldon Jr. and Cavalry to get one of those spots just to see how he'd do. But I'd say Ottawa, just based on that style of play, would be something where I'd especially going on the away leg of one of these trips, because that's obviously the hard part. You can see Ottawa grinding out maybe a good result, and then you go home and find a way to keep things tight. But I guess we'll see if they are able to grab that and make that a possibility next year.
And getting into our MLS roundup as well, there were some midweek games for the Canadian teams. TFC finally got a win, 3-1 over the Philadelphia Union. They scored a goal. They scored a goal at home. Terry Dunfield finally gets some good vibes on the bench in one of his final games with TFC as the head coach. He'll be sticking on staff, John Herdman said it in his presser. Ended a 13-match winless run for TFC, so certainly a good shot in the arm there for whatever that's worth at this point. New York City FC down CF Montreal 2-0, while the Vancouver Whitecaps beat the Chicago Fire 1-0. And on the weekend, CF Montreal saw their struggles continue, were booed by the home fans at Stade Saputo as the Columbus Crew and Wilfred Nancy saw them off 4-2, and New York City FC tied the Vancouver Whitecaps 1-1 in what was an ugly game at Yankee Stadium. And every time I see a game at Yankee Stadium, I'm just like, it's ridiculous. I went to a match there in, I think it was 2018, I saw them play Colorado there, and like I'm sitting in the corner and you're miles away from everything. You're kind of near the near corner, but the stadium's flat. There's not much of a bowl, really, because, you know, baseball.
Yeah.
It was such a weird experience. Unenjoyable.
Thank God for that stadium plan getting approved.
Yeah, just watching the NYCFC game, just please get a new stadium. It turns everything into just chaos ball. Just, you know, carnage in the midfield, no space on the wings. It's something to watch tactically. That's why I was also like, it was funny too, because I don't know if this was partly because of the stadium. Vanni Sartini also inverting Sam Adekunbi and Richie Larea was a bit of an interesting tactical wrinkle, because I'm like, given how small the field is, it feels like you're just kind of congesting it more by having them play inverted. Would you not want them to try to stretch whatever little space there is, even to stretch in the first place?
That's the problem. Like,
it's 70 yards know. Wide. I just felt like, but also like, why do you want them cutting inside? Because it's just they're cutting inside to just, you know, like I-5 traffic in LA. Like, it was just, I don't know. It was just a funny game to watch tactically. So I think it was honestly a good road point for the Whitecaps. 7 out of 9 road points in a week. Who would have ever seen that coming? And I mean, you add in, I mean, Montreal, it's a bit of an interesting one. Just again, especially the whole Wilfred Nancy part of them coming into that, and Montreal's certainly going to be in a dogfight to make the playoffs. But yeah, such a very, very weird week of MLS from the Canadian teams. You got the high of Vancouver, the low of Montreal, and then of course TFC in there grabbing their win. Certainly a high worth diving into.
I have a solution for the Yankee Stadium problem. At kickoff, have 2 or 3 guys just punch each other. Everyone gets red carded. We do 9v9. It's fine. There's tons
do
of space.
Do seven aside would be kind of cool.
It would be kind of cool. I don't understand how they plan to have like Messi play at Yankee Stadium. They're like, here's the sod, enjoy it.
He's gonna be like, you know what, never mind, I'm gonna go to Saudi Arabia.
Pun intended.
He's gonna complete 12 dribbles that game.
He can go end to end.
He'll find a way.
Anyways, the question from Johnny.
He'll probably Laurel. Love it. Less running.
That's true.
True. Yeah. And the question from Johnny Lower, what do you think of TFC pundits saying that a bad TFC team is also bad for Canada being Canada's team? I can't agree, and I'm hoping TFC and Herdman lose against a CPL team next year in the first round of the Canadian Championship. I like your thinking, Johnny. I've always not enjoyed the whole Toronto's team is Canada's team narrative, especially when you consider going back to the 2011 Canucks and how that wasn't Canada's team, but you can guarantee the idea of the Maple Leafs making a playoffs, in terms of doing anything in the playoffs, they're Canada's team. That's not happening with Vancouver.
They never said it for the Canadians. They never said it for the Senators when they made a final. They never, you know.
A team from Toronto is not, it's not Canada's team. I get that TFC was the first. I get that they have the Maple Leaf and the red and white, and they had the sort of cachet of being the first Canadian MLS team. But that messaging just, I don't know. It's a little bullshit.
Look, what I will say is, if we're talking about for the betterment of player development or for the national teams, then no, it does not matter. Just look at the World Cup squad. CF Montreal had, what, four members of that World Cup squad on it in terms of Samuel Piette, Kamal Miller, Alistair Johnston, and Ismail Kone, right? And then Joe Waterman got a call-up for Bahrain as well. So it goes to show you that it doesn't really matter. Even now, the Vancouver Whitecaps have a few Canadian internationals, certainly more than what TFC is going to be producing. If we're talking in terms of exposure, in terms of maybe quote-unquote growing the game, look, Toronto is the biggest city in Canada. We saw the buzz it created when they were successful from 2016 to 2018, at least temporarily. And that's just because the majority of the media is in Toronto. It is the first club in MLS. It's the oldest club to be in MLS. And you do wonder, would the Whitecaps or CF Montreal winning an MLS Cup or going far in the Champions League and making a final, would it actually reverberate around the country? I don't think so. It'd be massive for those markets because the Montreal Impact and the Vancouver Whitecaps have way more history than Toronto FC does, as we know historically going back years and years and years. So it would be massive for those markets, especially in Vancouver, let's be real, because at least CF Montreal and the Montreal Impact have had moments where they've actually been successful, and they've usually packed the stadium even when they haven't been very good. You can't say the same for the Whitecaps. If they did something of that magnitude, it would do wonders for that market and for that club, just in terms of creating a buzz in and around the city. But I don't think it would do anything nationally. And that's because of the fact of where they are. Like, I always go back to this not so hot take of mine, in that, let's say Alphonso Davies had the career arc he did, but instead of playing for Vancouver, he played for Toronto. How much more fanfare would he have gotten in the years that he was in MLS? Like, it would have been times 20, times 50, times 100. But because he played for a mediocre to below average Whitecaps team, and most of his games were at 10 p.m. or 10:30 Eastern at night on a weekend, no one really paid attention until the Bayern Munich transfer happened or when he got his Canada debut. But most of us who watched him in Vancouver had known about him forever and watched him every single week. And we were like, oh, this is becoming normal now. Whereas people in Toronto were like, oh my God, have you seen this kid? And we're like, well, yes, we have for the last 3 years. So it kind of goes to show you that in that way, yes, Toronto FC doing well would kind of help. But when it comes to the actual sporting side, looking at a national team lens, it really doesn't matter as long as one of the Canadian teams is actually producing players or giving opportunities to Canadian players.
On the Davies thing, though, I think there's a couple more levels of nuance there when you look at sort of the way that he was protected by the Whitecaps. Not only was he 10 p.m. in Vancouver that consistently doesn't get the coverage, hence why Ryan Gauld is not in the same conversations of like Hany Mukhtar and Lucho Acosta in terms of MLS MVP this year. Mm-hmm. But he was held back from the media. There's not a ton of media in Vancouver.
Which helps.
and so he was just left out of the limelight a lot, and maybe that did help with his
But what I'm saying though is, let's say the career arc was exactly the same.
Okay, so he was
played for Toronto.
True.
Like, the outside media frenzy would be much, much higher. Like, that is my point.
Well, that's it, because, again, Vancouver, even though Alphonso Davies was around, I mean, it was kind of in the bubble. Like, there wasn't, like, you know, there wasn't CBC The National doing any features on him or stuff like that to get his cadre out there, so to speak. So, it's something where it is interesting. But I mean, again, I'd say it comes down to talent development. I think that's what's most important for Canada, because I think we've also seen events from these teams where it's like, the Whitecaps had a moment where they created an Alphonso, or not created, pardon me, where they developed an Alphonso Davies. Montreal had a moment where they reach a Champions League final, we have to remember, and sold out Stade Olympique at the time to do so. TFC reaching a Champions League final, winning an MLS Cup. Yet, overall, you look back at those sorts of events, I don't think they had as drastic of an impact on the national team. They had all had an impact on the city. I mean, certainly I know for the Whitecaps, having a Davies around helped drive fan interest. That those Champions League runs for Montreal helped drive fan interest. I mean, you just have to know. I mean, MLS Cup, we know how it drove interest in TFC and, you know, where they were as a club. But ultimately, I think the development of players, what's going on in Montreal now is just as important, where they're starting six Quebecois players, for example. I think I see that, and that's just as important as any sort of success or, you know, ditto with the Whitecaps pushing players through their academy or out of their second team. And, you know, ditto with TFC, they've got the academy players there. Pushing those players through like a Kobe Franklin is just as important if we're talking purely from the national team perspective as winning an MLS Cup, because I think that's what Canada will care about. But of course it helps if you're having success and the youth are doing well, that's only going to help. But at the end of the day, like Alphonso Davies, like we saw, he got to where he was. He never won a trophy with Vancouver. He played what in like two finals and, you know, got battered in one of them by TFC. Like, that didn't impact his ability to go develop and become one of the stars for Canada. So I think from a pure Canadian men's national team perspective, you kind of, you know, again, the success, if TFC gets bounced in the first round of the Canadian Championship, as mentioned, but across the year, someone like, a Kobe Franklin, just because he's top of mind, goes out and gets 2,000 minutes, that's probably what's going to matter more to Canada than whatever happens to TFC in terms of results.
And from Mark Palich, please explain to me the value of TSN showing a doubleheader match with TFC and not the Whitecaps, but Portland. Also, why does TSN have a pre- and post-game show for only TFC games? Is it really just a ratings and demand issue? Two-part question. The first part is they were only given really what they could possibly get from Apple TV this year.
It's the rights thing.
They didn't have much of their choice in terms of what they would get. In terms of the pre-game and post-game shows, it's kind of always been that way.
Yeah, unless they had doubleheaders or tripleheaders involving the Canadian teams, then they would have the panel kind of going on until the end of the Whitecaps game, but that was usually quite rare. And that really would be a question for TSN production and content in terms of why would you have pre- and post-game shows for one team but not the other. I would imagine some of it has to do with timing as well, because the Whitecaps games would end at midnight or 12:30. You may not get out of the studio till 1 a.m. You're home at 2, what have you, right? Like all the people who'd be working that night. So that's one of the things. But also, you're working in sports. It comes with the territory. You're going to have late nights, as we all know, right? So I think that's really more so really a ratings and demand issue, and or people being in their Toronto bubble possibly and thinking, yeah, we have the viewership here. And the ratings have always been stronger for TFC games than the other Canadian teams, which definitely comes into it. But when it comes to the first part, it's absolutely the fact that Apple has a certain say over what games they can then repackage and redistribute to linear TV channels and whatnot.
And you also have to remember that for like TFC as well, like they're always going to have more ratings because it's also a bigger market to draw from. So from, you know, that's always been just the case, like for it's ditto with hockey. You see it as well, right? Like why is every Saturday since I was, you know, five, it's Maple Leafs pretty much every Saturday. Why? Well, because they have the biggest market to draw from. And I mean, ditto in MLS. So it's certainly frustrating when you're younger and, you know, you're maybe 14, 15, you're watching and you know, TFC would play at 4, Whitecaps play at 7, and then in that hour between 6 and 7, there would be more breaking down what happened to TFC versus previewing what happened to Vancouver. But also, again, I mean, in a lot of the cases, those sort of decisions are usually driven by ratings. And the fact is, you know, largely due to a mix of their just the overall size of the GTA and the market they're drawing from, as well as, you know, the success they've had, that TFC has always been the bigger draw in terms of viewers and all that than Vancouver. And I think from a network perspective, that will be always something that's considered, and rightfully so, because we do have to remember that these networks, at the end of the day, you have to push what helps, you know, bring in eyeballs, what helps, because that's always what's going to help keep the network alive and keep the network, the funding and all that. So in that case, it's something where, as frustrating as it is for those out in the West Coast or in Montreal, that's kind of usually the decision-making process. Whether or not you would agree with it, it's a different story, but that's usually the process.
The Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules for Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. Some notable Canucks Abroad mentions this week include Alphonso Davies. Didn't get an assist this week, but he went 90 in Byron's come-from-behind 2-1 win over Borussia Mönchengladbach. Jonathan David helped Lille qualify for the Conference League group stage by scoring in their 1-1 draw with Rijeka in their second leg playoff. David also started Sunday's league win over Montpellier. And from Michael at Mick_Maz, what is your guys' take on Jonathan David staying at Lille through the transfer window? Was this the right call, or did he miss out on an opportunity at a bigger club?
I suppose he did miss out on an opportunity at a bigger club, just because he could have gotten a step up, and it unfortunately didn't happen for a variety of reasons, being Lille's price tag, his wage demands reportedly anyways, which would have priced him out of several clubs in Italy as well as in Germany and what have you, because there were clubs that were interested. They just didn't end up pulling the trigger because there were more cost-efficient options out there. So for him, it's not the worst, because as well, you do see a lot of clubs who prioritize signing, especially strikers, in that sort of 24 to 26 age range, because they've had a few years of polished play in those top five leagues, especially at established clubs like Lille. And then they're more ready to make that step up because they're a bit used to the pressure. They're obviously a bit more fully cooked. They still have a bit of resale value. But they're also still old enough to be able to give you something, right? Whereas when you pay, say, 75 million euros plus 10 million in add-ons for Rasmus Højlund, who's played basically 3,000 professional minutes in his career and is still quite raw, there is a massive risk there because you paid a lot. Yes, he's young, but is that move to a top-tier club coming a bit too early? And that's a debate that you can have. It is worth looking at that side of it. I mean, it would have been nice for, I think just for David himself, to have moved to a club of that stature, because with that comes extra pressure that translates to the national team. And then when he's playing on those big stages, maybe he's a bit more used to playing under that pressure week in and week out. Not that he isn't getting that at Lille, but if he were playing for, and I'll just throw it out there, but a Manchester United or even a Tottenham or a Brighton, you always have those eyes on you because there's extra media pressure, there's extra fan pressure, and you're playing in a league that's watched by millions and millions of people. So with that is going to come that pressure to succeed.
Oh, look, I think the way I see the Jonathan David thing, and I mean, it's kind of how I feel about it is, look, I think it's disappointing he didn't get a move, no doubt, because I think what's unique about his situation at Lille is kind of, he's proved a lot of what he's needed to prove. Like, he's had three seasons of double digit goals. He won Ligue 1 the first year, which kind of, you know, I think this is also different. If he doesn't win that trophy in year one, at least now you could be like, okay, go out and win Ligue 1, like go be the guy on a team that goes win the league. They kind of had that moment already in year one. He's just continually improved his goals year after year. He also had a taste of Champions League and performed relatively well there, scored a couple of goals, you know, in the Europe's premier competition. I think because of all that, he's kind of proven what he's needed to prove at Lille. So I think it's something where what I love to see him make a jump up. Absolutely. But I think also what's also important to remember, this isn't a case where maybe, say, if he was still at Ghent, for example, or in a different club, like there's a lot worse places to be stuck, quote unquote, because I mean, stuck is very harsh, but there's a lot worse places to be than in a top five league, at a club like Lille, a club that's pushing for Europe, that's going to be in Europe in some form, and having that pressure of, look, like, this is a, I mean, this PSG team ended up making some good signings at the end of the window, but they've looked vulnerable to start the year. Maybe Lille can push for a title again. So I think, again, there's worse places to be. I just think for David personally, he's been in the league for 3 years. He's proven a fair amount, especially when you see what strikers like Højlund have done. Typically, a lot of strikers who have had David's sorts of profile and numbers have usually got a sort of move. But as we've seen, the price tag has been a huge thing. The contract he signed, so what, it was a five-year deal at the time. So obviously, I was always going to give Lille all the leverage. I think that's, again, it's just the reality of the situation. And hopefully a move, you know, facilitates itself eventually. I mean, certainly the fact that his contract is up in 2 years, I find it hard to imagine he'd re-up based on how clear he said he's like, I want to go test myself. I want to make that jump up. And certainly, I mean, next year's kind of like, I think, where the final line of the sand's going to be, because that's the final year of the contract. Lille's not getting anything if he doesn't, if he isn't sold next summer. I mean, they're not getting anything for him in the January after, with 6 months to go. And then if not, he'd leave for a free. So I think definitely now in this next year, then you're still in the top five league. You're still at a good club. Go out and score a bunch of goals, push for a league and title. And then certainly he'll get that move. But yeah, it is disappointing not to get it, because he deserves it. But also, I guess, you know, Lille did sign him for 5 years. They also obviously want a player like David. He's going to be huge for them to have any chance at Europe, at title hopes. But it's just unfortunate, because obviously David's ready for a move up, and he's made that intention clear. So it kind of leaves you in a bit of a interesting situation.
Tejon Buchanan exited Club Bruges' league game against Ghent with another suspected hamstring injury. Alistair Johnston started in Celtic's 1-0 win over Rangers in the Old Firm on Sunday, but exited with a precautionary injury in the 65th minute. Theo Corbenou scored his first goal for Grasshoppers in their 2-1 loss to Stade Ouchy. And from Shane, at ShaneW613, Theo Corbenou has a goal and 3 assists in 6 games for Grasshoppers this season. Do you think he sees minutes against Japan?
I think he certainly would get a call. I mean, we'll see, but minutes, just because it's one friendly, and obviously Canada has to have the unfortunate balance of both probably, you know, getting used to a new manager as well as looking forward to the November qualifiers. But I mean, I'd like to see Corbianu get a look, perhaps maybe up front. If you, we also have to see what this, you know, new manager ends up doing. Like, are they going to potentially switch to a 4-3-3? If so, I think that would help Corbianu immensely in his chance to get minutes. Whereas if they do stick with the 3-5-2, I'd only maybe see him get a chance up front. I know he's played wing back in the past, but as we've seen, he's, you know, he's best when he is on the wing in an attack minded position. I could see him maybe getting a look at a second striker, but certainly he'll get a look within the Canada fold. That's for sure. And I think he deserves it. I mean, he's gone to Switzerland to prove himself, and you know, a goal and 3 assists, his performances have been overall solid as well. To go along with the production, that's what you want to see from a young player like him. And I think hopefully he can keep this up, because consistency will also be key. But I think at this rate, you know, he'll definitely get some sort of look in that camp, and hopefully that translates to him maybe getting any sort of minutes against Japan. Although I'd imagine that comes maybe more in a bit of a sub role or a chance off the bench versus a start.
Prince Harry, Selena Gomez, and Tom Holland were out at LAFC to watch Kamal Miller and Inter Miami earn a massive 3-1 win over the home side, with Miller going 90 in that one. Miami is now 8 points back of the final playoff spot in the East with 9 games remaining. Liam Fraser made his full debut for Dallas in their 2-2 draw with Atlanta United on Saturday, going 79 minutes. Liam Miller is back in the English Championship with Preston North End after joining from Basel on deadline day. Kosi Thompson is the latest TFC Academy grad to move to Norway, joining Lystrom on loan. And as for the women abroad, Jordan Heidema scored for OL Reign in their 1-0 win over the Orlando Pride. And Bianca St. George also scored for the Chicago Red Stars in their 2-0 victory over the Washington Spirit. And from WSoccerCA, any thoughts on Adriana Leon's omission from the Manchester United training camp squad? Also, what are your takeaways from Ashley Lawrence's first appearance for Chelsea v Roma?
I mean, with Leon, it's pretty obvious in that she's just not rated at United. She's got to get out of there. No surprise that she was omitted in the end. And it's now imperative that she finds a move. Maybe she can go back to the NWSL, but then again, she also wasn't playing much of Portland either before the World Cup. So it's one of those situations where you're out of favor at your club. You got an opportunity on loan in a league that you're familiar with on one of the top teams in that league too, and you didn't really end up making much of an impact there either. So it's going to be a fascinating situation for her. That's for sure.
Yeah, for Leon, I'm curious to see where she ends up, because we also saw that AC Milan bid very last minute in the January window, I think it was, but it just fell through, because I think that was an interesting possibility. Maybe she considers going to Italy. But certainly, I think one thing's for clear. I think she's feels like she's kind of done. The writing is on the wall at United, and, you know, fair enough. It hasn't worked out. Maybe somewhere else in England. She's also obviously had the history at West Ham. So maybe perhaps another club in England can have a look. If not, I would be interested. Maybe see her go to like a Serie A. That could be intriguing. Add to another Canadian playing in the league, of course, along the likes of Julia Grosso and Evelyne Vian. So that could also be an interesting possibility. And hopefully it happens for Leon. As for Ashley Lawrence, I mean, look, from what we were able to piece together, of course, the friendly was streamed, so it's interesting to see Chelsea going up against Roma and Evelyne Vian, of course, as we mentioned. For Lawrence, kind of wondering what side of the back four would she play, what things are going to look like. Looks like she's slotting in at right back for Emma Hayes, and it's going to be fascinating because over the last few years, Hayes has played a lot with kind of inverted wingers. Left Lawrence with a lot of ground to cover on the touchline, but that's kind of where she's at her best. As we saw for Canada in the summer, she didn't get to go as forward as much. She had to play, she was stuck further back. It's trying to build up, where she's kind of at her best when she can help start the build up, but then also make those overlapping runs in the final third. And so far from this first game, Chelsea kind of allowed her the freedom to go up and down that touchline, where I think she's at her best. And I think that as long as they get that sort of extra coverage in the midfield, which they should, they'll be playing likely a version of a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3. So I think Lawrence is going to fit in well with Chelsea. And we kind of got a glimpse of it, and I'm excited to see as it develops, especially when the league season starts, because I think Lawrence is really going to do well down that right flank for them in both in the league play and in Europe.
And from VDH_S, what's going on with Junior Hoylett? Is it only a matter of time before he ends up with Herdman at Toronto FC?
Yeah, he was linked to his former manager, Neil Warnock, a few weeks ago at Huddersfield Town, which I was kind of surprised that didn't end up going through, because, I mean, he's still a serviceable championship player in multiple positions now, because he played wingback last year, and we know he can play as a winger, possibly as a number 10 as well, probably more so wingback/winger at this stage of his career in the championship, mind you. But if that doesn't work out, I mean, yeah, TFC could end up being a landing spot for him. He was linked there a couple of years ago before he signed with Reading, and his relationship with John is quite strong. So I think that it could be a pretty big possibility, to be honest.
Yeah, it's curious to see where he ends up. The only thing is, I'm pretty sure MLS is roster freezes September 15th, so it'd have to happen very soon, within the next 10 days as of recording, because of course in Europe it's different. With it being early in the season, he could sign in November as a free agent if you know that's what ends up happening. So I think for MLS, will be if there is anything, we'll have to see it quick. It is, you know, because of course TFC also looking at a Sebastian Giovinco. Might that happen? Might Hoylett fit in? But I think at this stage of the proceedings, it might be a bit late for MLS. So I'd probably expect him to stick around in England, although I am surprised it's taken this long as a free agent, because we're what now, like 5, 6, 7 games already to the season in some cases in the championship and whatnot.
And from Mark East, what's this FIFA rule change being reported that players can switch national team allegiance if they have not played 4 games? Does that include friendlies? And are there any players in the Canadian pool that could merit another look on the national team? There were also a few questions about whether this brings Tomori back into the picture.
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously there's been the news bandied about, shout out to Evan Ferguson, balling out for Brighton, got that big hat trick over the weekend, Irish, eligible for England. And obviously the English tabloids and media have kind of run with, oh, well, he could switch to England. And this new rule change, first and foremost, the new rule change they're talking about, it happened in 2020. It's the same rule change. It's the one we're very familiar with here in Canada because of someone like a Fakayo Tomori. So first of all, Ferguson is eligible. He's only 18, so he doesn't tick off a lot of the boxes. As we know, under the new rules, you either have to be well, you have to be under 21 and no more than 3 competitive appearances. Of course, as we know, Tomori's made 3, but because he is over 21, basically any appearances after the rules change is what ruled him out. So he was actually eligible because he'd made 1 appearance before the rule change at 22. So he was eligible to make the switch, but then he's made 2 appearances for England since the rule change after the age of 22. So Tomori's unfortunately still, well, he's cap tied to England. He will continue to play for England. He got called up this window, which is good. I hope he plays because, I mean, first and foremost for his career and just because I think he's one of England's best center backs. And I have no idea why Gareth Southgate refuses to even give him a look versus some of the options they've had. But that's a whole other story to talk about. But yes, Fakayo Tomori remains ineligible for Canada. But there are some interesting players who this rule change, you know, again, not rule change because it happened 2-3 years ago, but the rule applies to. I mean, Stefan Mitrovic is one of them. He wouldn't be eligible until 2025, but he's someone where he made his debut for Serbia under the age of 21. He's only made 1 appearance. If he makes any more appearances now, because he's past the age of 21, he would be cap tied to Serbia. But he is one of those players who is eligible, whereas a Tomori, whereas a Dominik Jankov, whereas a Omar Marmoush, all those guys are off the table. And, you know, in the case of the latter two guys, it's because they've made way too many appearances along with their age. So just important to consider. I know, obviously, this news, you see new rule change, all that sort of stuff. I think it's just the English tabloids are a bit late on because, you know, it hasn't really applied to them up to this point. Whereas they see Ferguson, they're like, oh, new rules. And it kind of led to all that confusion.
And from Dan Clark, what does the CSA need to do in order to right the wrongs of what has gone down in the last 18 plus months? Every time I think they've hit rock bottom, they seem to do something to make things worse, and I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. The only way I can see them getting out of it is somehow getting out of the CSB contract. Or, I was bandying around this idea the other day, sell the CSA to a private company. See if there's buyers out there who want to fund and have this band, like brand/business that is the CSA.
Yeah, that would be an interesting question to see if that's even possible.
I'm not sure whether it is, but
like, I mean, literally the only answer is they have to find a way to get money in, right? And it's a conversation we've been having now for the last however many years now, right? And this is why we find ourselves in this situation, because not only were the women successful, the men were successful. They had to spend a lot of money in order to get to that World Cup because of COVID, because of the amount of games they had to play. It was an unprecedented level of spending, at least to the federation standards. And now they're paying for it now, especially after signing that CSB deal in 2018, which they could actually be hampered by until as late as 2038. And what's even worse now is it looks like that there are going to be more budget cuts coming based on the reports that you read. Because if we thought 2023 was bad, apparently 24 is going to be bad, 25 is going to be bad, and so on and so forth. And we're now paying for it now because there's only 1 friendly coming for the men. And the women are apparently going to be playing in games in every single window, which is great for them, but now the men are suffering as a result. So you're just going through this constant juxtaposition of, oh, okay, the men are now getting the majority of the spending, okay, but now the women suffer, and now it's vice versa. And this is why, and I know you guys talked about this last week at length on the Emergency podcast about John moving to Toronto, but people the last week or two in the media have been talking about John leaving the national team, moving to Toronto FC, and, oh, this is a great opportunity. Sometimes coaches wear out their welcomes. Usually it's only 4 years for an international manager. Anyways, they usually stick around for 1 cycle, and sometimes you need a fresh voice in there. Like, guys, this isn't Didier Deschamps leaving France, where you can just bring a new coach in of a high pedigree with a ton of resources. John was propping up this program in spite of the federation. He brought in analysts. He brought in an enhanced medical team, which was among the best in the world, by the way. Like, the work that Cesar Millan did over the last few years was unprecedented, and for the women's team as well when he was there. Like, these are things that people don't really see, and he raised the overall standards. That's why a post-John Herdman future is scary. Because when you lift the standards up to a certain level and prop up the program to a level that it probably could have never even foreseen a few years ago, what's going to happen when the man responsible now leaves, right? And especially when you're getting budget cuts in there, what on earth is going to happen? I know you guys talked about this last week, so we won't get into it, but this is why the future is scary and why they desperately need to find this injection of funds now. Because if you can't bring in those same levels of standards post John Herdman, then the Federation and the program is going to be screwed. I'm sorry. Especially leading into a home World Cup. And this is why I think everybody is so afraid of what's coming in the future. And it's going to only be solved if we can bring in some extra funds, whether that's privately, whether that's through CSB pumping in more money, or maybe some sponsors kind of backing a new coach to come in and maybe bolstering the budget for them, and so on and so forth. But that is certainly something that I think a lot of people have kind of not realized when talking about the post John Herdman future of the men's national team, especially. And even Bev Priestman as well. Like, if she leaves, what on earth is going to happen to the women's program? Because she was able to pick up where John left off. And I know that there was Kenneth Heiner-Moeller in there in the middle, but he didn't really do a whole lot. But she picked up where John left off, got them an Olympic gold medal. And yeah, okay, the World Cup didn't end up panning out the way it did for the reasons that we went over a few weeks ago. But it's the same argument there as well. Like, as soon as you take out the people who are thriving and succeeding in spite of what's happening around them, then it's very justifiable to be afraid of what's coming.
And from Johnny Laura, how do you think Biello will handle the October window? Do you think he'll use the opportunity to do a huge refresh on the squad, like dropping basically all the veterans?
I don't know how many veterans he'll drop, but I think it's something where no matter if Herdman was still in place or Biello or the new coach, I think it's something where Canada's going to have to start looking ahead to 2026 anyways. And of course, you got the Copa America qualifiers in November to look forward to. But I do think it's something where you kind of have to balance that with transitioning to the future. And I think as we've kind of started to see, a lot of Canada's best options now are also options that are there for the future in most cases. So I think we'll likely see a bit of a transition phase anyways. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe some veterans drop. It also depends on form, for example. There's countless examples across the board, but you look, just two examples that you see out there, like a Steven Vittoria, his minutes have dropped at Chavez, and he's kind of, because he struggled to start the year. That's something where maybe if he was playing a bunch, you're talking about him starting, maybe he still gets in the camp, but I'd be looking at, like Cornelius, Kamal Miller, Scott Kennedy's playing regularly at his new club. Lucas McNaughton, Joel Waterman, et cetera, like you go down that list versus a Vittoria, and then you go look at a Milan Borjan. He made his move to Bratislava, started out well, but then in Champions League, there's a few performances to forget and push Bratislava all the way down. I think Conference League it was, and also in the league, I mean, the Slovakian league is the overall standard maybe isn't as high as it was even in Serbia or elsewhere. Because of that, his form dipping a bit, might we see, the likes of a St. Clair or, maybe even a Jonathan Sirois come in? Absolutely. So I think it's also something where a lot of these veterans, I'm looking across the board, most of them are, kind of already getting pushed by younger players, and that's kind of a good thing, and that's kind of what you want.
And from Avery UN, how do we change tactically and positionally with Biello in charge? I don't think you're going to see too much different at this camp, just because it's one game and it'll probably, it's either going to be so many changes or it's probably going to be just continue on with what John and Biello have built up to this point.
I'd say the only tweak I'd watch out for is potentially a back four. I think especially depending on the center back options, because I think clearly it's Cornelius's time. I mean, it's clear his performances have shown it. So potentially if Cornelius is starting, do they stick with the back five? Because also we have to remember that a back three, a large part of it was due to the, lack of speed that Canada had at the back, a lack of options. Whereas, okay, if a Vittoria might not be playing because he's not getting minutes at the club level, and it's Cornelius could also play in a back four. To be fair, he's also anchoring down the middle of a back five at Malmo very well, so he could just slot in that role for Vittoria seamlessly. But I do wonder if we see that, because I know Biello, course, it's different circumstances with the U20s, U18s. He's also done hybrids where you kind of play with the back four, and then you have a number six that kind of shifts between. We've seen Justin Smith play that role. Pretty sure you've even seen Biello's son play that role, funnily enough, Alessandro Biello, for the U17s. So maybe we see something like that. But other than that, I don't foresee many changes. It'll probably be pretty similar tactically, pretty similar formation-wise, other than maybe a couple of tweaks.
And from Mark East, Julian de Guzman said on TSN that the Canaman team needs a coach with stature to manage and get buy-in from the big names and egos in the locker room. He implicitly cast cold water on the idea of a fresh face from the CPL like Smir Niotis. What are your thoughts on this? I think he has to be a little bit more realistic, to be honest.
Well, I mean, of course you'd love a coach with stature, but also, again, I think it's something where I feel like that's kind of overblown a lot. You just kind of need the coach with the right message, the right tactics, and have it all come together. Because I'd immediately, I mean, again, it's an easy comparison, but I'd immediately point to, you know, what you see at Morocco with, you know, Walid Regragui. Again, that's someone who was coaching, he hadn't really coached a whole lot of top level teams, so to say. He didn't have that reputation. He was coaching in Morocco, where he was doing a great job, won an African Champions League. Scaloni. But that's someone who came in, and there you go, another example. Lionel Scaloni comes in. I think for international, it's just you got to get that right voice, that right tactical identity, that right hire. So that's why for me, it's like that right hire could be in the CPL, that right hire could be in the USL, that right hire could be in MLS. It could also be, you know, in Europe. I think it's something where you kind of have to look more at the profile. You have to look more at the reputation versus the idea of stature, because I think personally, I think that's overblown, especially international, where it's kind of like you have to get that buy-in. You have to get that sort of success, because it's such a unique part of the game versus, you know, club football.
And from Felix Blanchette, I know you talked a bit about it in the past, but with the FIBA World Cup going on and Canada making a run, semifinals now, I can't help but compare. They've got a domestic league in place, the CBL, without funneling a national program money to it. They've got it on mainstream TV. Of course, the CBL is on TSN and the World Cup is on Sportsnet. They don't have any organizational issues the CSA has, and don't have beef with the national teams and the federation. They seem to make the most of their own golden generation with the men, and don't have the beef between the CEBL and the Raptor fans that we seem to have between segments of the CPL and MLS club fan bases. What can we learn from Canada basketball, and how can we be more like them? I think over the last few years, Canada basketball has made a ton of very good decisions. Part of that good decision was from the start of the CEBL. They had an idea of how to create an identity around that league. They had an idea of a longer-term vision of that league, and they wanted to get it in front of people at any cost from the start. And that meant getting it on CBC from the start and having it just viewable from the beginning. I think you also have to credit that there are a lot of Canadian basketball players. There are a lot of Canadian basketball players who aren't playing in the summer. There's a lot of Canadian basketball players across the world. There's a lot of Canadian basketball players that play in Europe in the winter season. This is a summer league that is part-time, but you could still build those brands around them. You could bring up players that played in college. You also didn't necessarily have certain media companies not wanting to see the league succeed in terms of performance on and off the competition field. You didn't necessarily have a media company that was actively working against the success of the league in many ways. And you also look at Canada basketball, and there's several programs that they've been able to fund and find success in. Of course, they've been a regular competitor at the Olympics in women's basketball. Now they're back there in the men's. And then they run this 3v3 program that has World Cup stops around the world, and they're across the world in that. So they're doing everything right at Canada basketball. In terms of what you can learn from Canada basketball, I think it's just somehow create an identity around your brand, create an identity around your league as well. And then good things will follow.
It's also hard to compare, I feel like, the CEBL versus the CPL, just in terms of what they're kind of working with, because I mean, as we've learned across the last few years, it just feels like a lot of what happens in soccer in this country is a lot of infighting, a lot of eating your own kind of thing, right? Whereas, I mean, basketball's kind of been different just because it's been something that's really come on over the last 10, 20 years, like the rush of guys like Steve Nash and the success he had at the NBA level. And then, of course, the Raptors kind of pushed a lot of Canadians to get into the sport. So it's been such a late rising thing. So they've kind of been able to, you know, just go at this in a fresh way, like, all right, let's create a league, boom. Or, you know, like, let's really push prominence in the national program. Whereas we have to remember, for soccer, it's been around for so long, right? Like, I mean, the men went to a World Cup in 86. The women, you know, ever since coming on the scene in the 90s have had a lot of success. You know, you look at clubs like the Whitecaps have been around since the 70s. Like, there's a history. Of course, you can say there's that history for basketball. The game was invented up here after all. But for the most part, a lot of the, you know, the big movement in basketball has gone on south of the border, whereas Canada's always had that rich history with soccer. But what that meant is also there's been a system where there's a lot of, you know, battle lines. There's a lot of, you know, eating your own, a lot of clear territorial things have cropped up. And I think a lot of that has kind of come up, especially over the last few years with all of Canada's success. And it kind of opens up the issues that were already there. So I think it's also a reality where it feels like Canada basketball has had a lot fresher of a slate to work with, because there was so many dark years there and so much nothingness going on that now they've kind of reached a good era. And it's good to see. I'm happy to see Canada be competitive at basketball. I'm happy that next summer, you know, be able to watch the men in the Olympics. Hopefully they're able to get all their best players for that. But I think it's also just been something where I've been looking. It's been hard to compare the two scenarios just because they've been in such different situations. And I think a closer comparable would be hockey, because that's something where, you know, Canada, of course, it's very different just because hockey's always kind of been Canada's sport. But you see there all the problems that have cropped up on the organizational level with Hockey Canada, I think kind of shows as well. That's a similar deal where there's a lot of, you know, the same problems, the infighting, the whole money model, the, you know, of course, the you know, the scandals. And I'd say Hockey Canada shows that, you know, that I personally, I see more of a comparison there was Canada basketball is kind of, I'm excited to where they'll go, because I look around the barrier to entry, the amount of kids I see wanting to take up basketball, it's going to be a boon in that sport. But for soccer and even hockey, it's something where they'll have a lot of work to do to clean up some of those messes and make these sports, you know, worth that same sort of interest. Although I think soccer has that beat just because, again, every kid's always going to sign up for soccer. It's the easiest sport to play as a parent. Just get your boots, you get your shin pads, you throw the kids out. Hockey is a whole other story. We're not going to dive into it. We're not a hockey podcast. So soccer is going to have that ease of entry, but also from there, you have to make sure that, you know, you're creating a pathway, creating a pipeline so that these kids can also dream of having success in this sport in the country. That so that they're not looking at other sports and be like, okay, well, we love soccer, but just isn't going to work, and maybe look elsewhere.
I think you also have to mention that when funding a national program for basketball and looking at a league and making the league successful, you have less players and you have less staff. And in a summer league like the CEBL, you've made it more popular than the CPL, and I don't think there's much argument on that. But you're not paying full-time wages because it's a summer league, and you're only playing for 3 months of the year. So you have to take a look at what is the CEBL compared to the CPL, where the CPL is, of course, looking to pay full-time wages, ideally, even though a lot of the wages that players actually take home is nowhere near full-time. And so it's a straight comparable, and in many ways, it's not. As you said, it can relate both to Canada basketball as well as Hockey Canada. But I think that's all we've got for episode 138 of the Northern Football Podcast. Certainly nice to be talking something other than tire fire in Canadian soccer, like last week's podcast, John Herdman leaving to TFC. But for Alex Gungi-Ruzic and Peter Galindo, I've been Ben Steiner. Thanks so much for listening.